Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, I'm Georgie Ainsley, and every week I talk to someone who is a performance person. They could be an athlete from the world of entertainment, business, or politics. They could even be an astronaut. The key link is, of course, that they all know how to perform at the top level, and they can teach us all a thing or two about how to do that in our own lives, at whatever it is that we do. Performance People is available wherever you get your podcasts, or of course, you can watch us on YouTube, where you can also subscribe, and please do.
Professor Greg White OBE is a former Olympian and a sports scientist. He's been instrumental in comic relief and sport relief challenges, training and coaching celebrities like David Walliams, John Bishop, Davina McCall, Eddie Izzard and Vernon Kay to do extraordinary things for extraordinary causes. He's a professor in applied sport and exercise science at Liverpool John Moores University and a UK authority on exercise physiology, sports performance and rehab.
It's actually around about 18 hours in. That's the misery point. So what you've got to think is that everything up to that point is a warm-up. When we summited Snowdon, which is the first thing that we did, the temperature at the top of Snowdon was colder than the North Pole that day. The greatest gains in performance, whatever that performance is, the greatest gains generally always come from those things that you don't like doing. Success is not a chance event. You're not suddenly... you haven't decided to enter the London Marathon and then sit on the sofa watching telly. You know, you can't just watch Forrest Gump and expect to be able to run a marathon.
Greg, I feel like you're the sort of person that everyone needs one of you in their life. Because I feel like with you in your life, you can achieve anything. And I was watching Strictly with my daughter at the weekend because one of our dearest, closest, most lovely friends, Annabelle, is performing and she's doing amazingly and we're so proud of her. I was watching her and watching the journey that she'd been on. And then I was simultaneously, because I don't think we can ever just do one thing at any one moment anymore, I was simultaneously Googling you because I knew that we had this pod coming up. And you were responsible for keeping Tess and Claudia going for 24 hours in the dance-a-thon for Comic Relief, of which you've done so many different projects. How on earth do you teach people to stay on their feet in a dance-a-thon for 24 hours? Where the heck did you start with that?
Well, you know, I mean, it's an interesting one. I mean, that was really good fun, actually, 24 hours with Tess and Claudia. Some are more fun than others. I've actually done 39 sport relief, comic relief and children in need challenges. So there's been a few of them. And you know, some of them are more arduous than others, but that was a good fun one. I think to some extent, you know, much of what it's about is actually about the relationship, and it's about just understanding the challenger and understanding what makes them tick, and then effectively supporting them in just modifying the way that I support somebody, just to ensure that what you're doing is you're speaking to them directly. So there's no sort of magic formula to it in a sense. It really is about relationship building and then making sure that what you do the information remains the same, but the way in which you impart that and translate it and then support changes every time we do a challenge.
See, I go at everything like a steam train, 100 miles an hour. So my issue would be the staying power piece, because to be able to maintain a thing, to keep that sort of leveled consistency going, I mean, how do you overcome that? Because I bet a ton of people, you've worked with so many different celebrities, do the same thing. They come at it with full of enthusiasm, full of like vigor for the challenge and overexcitement. How do you like temper that to make sure they actually do it properly and do it to the end?
Do you know, in essence, I would say it's probably the most important thing. And I think often people say to me, what's the difference between working with elite athletes, you know, which I did for decades, and working with celebrities? I think to some extent, in terms of the performance aspect of it, one thing remains true. It is about pacing and actually making sure that you can control that pacing. Of course, exactly the same as it is for an athlete coming into the Olympics, for example, is that for one of these big challenges, they've spent a huge amount of time and effort and thought, really, which I think is the most important thing, in preparing for the challenge. And then all of a sudden you're there, you know, it's race day, the competition's on, the challenge is on. And so the temptation is, and I think what's interesting about it as well is that often what we do is we focus on the challenger, but these are big teams that work on these projects. And everybody in the team has been working really hard for a long period of time. Everybody's excited. You know, everybody's like, let's go, let's smash this, let's do it. And what you've got to do really is make sure that everybody is singing off the same hymn sheet, that everybody's relaxed, everybody is calm. Because the way that I always sort of interpret it to people is this sort of classic way in which we talk about sports performance is negative split. In that what we should be doing is speeding up. The second half should be faster than the first half. And I think if you can get the pacing right on day one, then day two becomes that much easier, as long as you get the pacing right on day two and so on and so forth. And, you know, for a 24-hour challenge, for example, what you have to think is, I always say to the guys, look, it's actually around about 18 hours in. That's the misery point. So what you've got to think is that everything up to that point is a warm-up. You've just got to pace yourself into that 18, because you're going to need everything you need at hour 18 through to 22. And then the final couple of hours, you know, relatively simple. And so, you know, for Vernon last week, when we did the ultra marathon, actually it was the big day, without any shadow of doubt, was day three. Very long day. It was a 30 mile. It wasn't the longest day, but it was the toughest, because he already had 70 miles in his legs. So pacing is absolutely key. Get the pacing right and you've got a much better chance of being successful.
So you mentioned Vernon Kay there. I'm going to ask you to name drop, because it's the only way that we can understand or that people listening or watching can truly understand how many amazing people you have worked with. Because like you say, there are elite athletes in there, there are celebrities in there, whether it be preparing people for the Olympics, whether it be preparing people for a crazy comic sport relief challenge. Just give me a list of the people that you've worked with, because it will make everyone pay attention.
Wow. Well, I mean, it all started back in 2006, and that was David Walliams when we swam across the English Channel. And since that time, there's been a whole host of absolute legends, really. Davina McCall in an ultra triathlon. Greg James twice, when we did five triathlons in five cities in 5 days, and the pedal to the peaks through the Beast of the East, which was something. John Bishop, who was incredible in his Arc to Arch challenge. Joe Brand was absolutely amazing. Zoe Ball, incredible cycle ride down from Blackpool to Brighton, an absolute epic. And obviously Vernon at the weekend. And then also the whole host of different 24-hour challenges that we've done with effectively the whole Radio 2 crew, but also Joe Wicks. We did a 24-hour day of PE with him. The list goes on. I mean, some of my favourites, though, are the team events that we've done. So we did a £1 million cycle, and that was really great fun with the likes of Jimmy Carr and Miranda Hart and Davina and David. There's been over sort of 50, I think it's around about 55, 60 celebrities over 39 challenges. And that's before you even touch the Olympians who I've worked with, who are, you know, formidable, the best athletes on the planet. And interestingly enough, much of my sort of most recent work, actually, and sort of my day job, as it were, is actually working with cancer patients in preparation for surgery. So what we call prehabilitation, which is an incredibly difficult environment to work in, but incredibly rewarding as well. So, it's an interesting eclectic mix, which is what makes it great.
God, that is incredible, isn't it? That is a cross-section. And do you do the challenges with people or do you just train them for it?
Both is the answer to that. So I sort of do the sort of technical behind the scenes stuff, ranging from things like selection of footwear for Vernon, for example, or selection of bikes, as it was for the million-pound cycle or for Davina, et cetera. The training program itself, and then often I do a lot of the training program with the guys, because I think what you always have to remember is that they've got enormous skill, just not in what they're being challenged at. They are outstanding authors, singers, TV presenters, etc. But what they're not is that they don't necessarily come from a physical background. And so actually making sure that they're doing the right thing at the right time in training is really important. And then generally I do the challenge with them, because the one thing that I can't create is experience. And experience really matters on the road around things like we've said about pacing, but actually things like feeding, hydration, knowing when to stop, how long to stop for, all of those type of things. So generally, that said, I didn't do the dancing with Tess and Claudia because nobody needs to see my moves, let me tell you.
Obviously, there are going to be common threads that sort of link these challenges, like how you can best prepare, what you can do during, what you can do after to look after yourself as well as you might. And we'll get to that in a moment. What's been the toughest one, do you think? Which is the one that sort of, there must be one, there's always one that stands out as the most challenging?
Wow. I think it's an interesting one, really, because I think, it's tough for various different reasons, I think. And so to pinpoint one in particular that's tough. And of course, first of all, it's actually about the challenger. What is their experience? Where have they come from? So you think something like Joe Brand, we walked from Hull to Liverpool in February across the highest point in England. And as we came across the highest point in England, the wind was blowing so strong, we actually watched the juggernaut being blown off the road. And so for a challenge like that, for Joe, incongruous to that challenge, really, 20 miles a day, this formidable challenge. Add on top of that, the environment, et cetera. You think about when we did the pedal to the peaks with Greg, the one stat I always love off that, Greg James, that is, off Radio 1. The one stat I love about that is we started on Snowdon. When we summited Snowdon, which is the first thing that we did, the temperature at the top of Snowdon was colder than the North Pole that day. So that makes it really challenging. And of course, when you get on a bike and you're moving at 20 miles an hour and you've got wind flow coming across you, things start to freeze up and you've got to be careful. But from a physical perspective, probably the toughest was when David Williams, when we swam the Thames. Mm-hmm. That was a formidable challenge, just because of number one is sort of the day after day, 7 days of effectively nonstop activity. You've got that accruing fatigue as you go through it. But then, of course, what you have layered on top of that is the fact that, and anybody who's done this, is that you've got sleep deprivation, because number one, you don't sleep that well. Number two is you haven't got that much time to sleep anyway. So that impacts on recovery. And then it's really strange that because I actually raced the Thames last year personally. And when you get sleep deprived and fatigued, all of a sudden the temperature, which is easily, you can cope with it on day one, suddenly becomes insidious and really cold and really miserable. And so these challenges get tougher and tougher as time goes on. So I think to pinpoint one that's the toughest, it would be a difficult one. I think swimming the Thames was probably up there. But actually, for everybody who's done one of these challenges, it has been a seriously tough challenge.
It's really interesting you mentioned sleep and sleep deprivation and how problematic that can be. I mean, new parents are always, I mean, everyone's always stunned when they have babies and suddenly discover what sleep deprivation really does look like. And it can do all sorts of, all manner of things to you in a way that you're able to deal with things on a regular daily basis. It can just throw that totally out the window, right? And it's an absolute head mess to deal with. I mean, how much importance do you place in the, especially when you're talking about the prehabilitation of cancer patients, how much importance do you place on sleep and why it matters as much as it does?
I mean, absolutely central. You know, it's interesting when we talk about lifestyle modification and enhancing lifestyle, you know, we talk about the classic things like, you know, moving more, being more active, eating better, reducing alcohol consumption, stopping smoking, but which are all incredibly important. But the one thing we generally tend to forget about is actually about recovery, rest and recovery as a totality. And of course, what is central to that rest and recovery is sleep. So we have this idea that we call the restorative sleep hypothesis. That being that much of the restoration, so much of the adaptation that we're trying to induce, much of the recovery that we're trying to gain comes during sleep. And so getting sleep right is absolutely crucial. And I would dare to say, you know, as you say, I've got three kids and you don't know what sleep deprivation is until you've had young children. Because it's actually the accruing of that sleep deprivation. It's like a bank account. It effectively what you're doing is you're constantly withdrawing till eventually you've got nothing left to withdraw. And so missing a single night's sleep is one thing, but actually doing that successively over multiple nights becomes really, really problematic. And all sorts of things are happening physiologically. You know, not only are you losing, losing energy and lethargy starts to take over, but things like you get suppression of immune function with sleep deprivation and absence of recovery. So therefore you're more susceptible to illness. If you add on top of that, cognitive performance starts to change. So decision-making becomes really problematic. And often you find people who are sleep deprived make really, really basic, simple mistakes in decision making simply because they're not recovering appropriately. So for me, it's one of those things that I think is so important, principally because it's the one thing that people think they can just forget about and not worry about. And this mentality of more is better. So just keep pushing, just keep driving, just keep working. And any elite athlete with experience will tell you it simply doesn't work. It is about its quality over quantity and making sure you get the right recovery, absolutely central.
What do you tell people who just fundamentally struggle with sleep or have, you know, sleep insomnia issues or how do you get them on track with their sleep? Because it's all very well saying sleep better, sleep longer, better quality sleep. But what if you can't?
And it's a real difficult one. And for some people, it's really, there are sort of multiple reasons why people sleep badly, you know, ranging from sort of physiological disorders all the way through to psychological disorders. You know, so basically the brain or the body is stopping quality of sleep. But I think some of the things that you can do are very, very simple to at least try and optimize sleep and to try and reduce the risk of poor sleep. So we call them things like sleep hygiene. And they really are basic. So what we do know is that you sleep better in a cooler environment. So make sure that the bedroom is not too hot. But of course, it's not just about the air temperature of the bedroom. It's also about inside the cover temperature. So make sure that the tog of the quilt that you're using is not too high so you don't get too hot. Make sure you've got the right pillow. Make sure you've got the right mattress so you are comfortable, you're well supported. Make sure it's dark. And that's an interesting one. Often we sort of all know these things, but generally we don't do anything about it. But a blackout blind is a great easy step that you can do to ensure that you've got darkness. Make sure it's quiet. And then it comes down to things like electronics in the bedroom are a really bad thing, particularly things like telephones and tablets, because what they do is they emit a light, a particular frequency, which actually induces wakefulness and will keep you awake. So it's absolutely banning electronics from the bedroom. And then it's things like gaining a routine. To some extent, what you've got to try and do is train the brain to sleep in preparation for it. So having, you know, going to bed at the same time every night, not always possible, but generally having a routine of bedtime matters. What you do before bed, interestingly, people think that exercise before bed is a bad thing. Actually, low intensity exercise. So things like Pilates or yoga or very light exercise can be a sleep inducer, so it can be really valuable. On the other end of that spectrum, there are things that are very, very bad for quality sleep, and that is alcohol. And generally people think, oh, do you know, I'll have a couple of glasses of wine and it'll get me off. Absolutely not. I mean, I'll show you some of the data that we have collected on that, which shows the catastrophic effect of alcohol on sleep quality. And it's an interesting one. You know, it's challenging that dogma that you believe will work for you, but actually some of it doesn't work. Also, things like sleeping tablets. Often, you know, people will turn to sleeping tablets. So what we sometimes call the benzodiazepines. So that these sort of range of drugs which we use. But generally, what they are is that they're not necessarily sleep inducers. They're muscle relaxants. They don't always add to quality of sleep. And we've done a number of studies looking at this. And in fact, people can actually wake. And if you've ever taken them, sometimes you wake in the morning feeling worse than when you went to bed. You feel really.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Really groggy and really lethargic. So I think what I would do is start simple and make sure that you've got the right environment for sleep. Make sure you've got the right routine to enhance your sleep quality. And then once you've done all of that, then what you can do is, if you're still not sleeping well, is then to look at other interventions which can help.
One of the things I've learned a lot about lately is the circadian rhythm. And it is really interesting how it relates back to how we live our lives and how we probably should live our lives. And we probably step away from that model more often than perhaps we should do. But also looking at my husband and him being a professional sportsman, you know, one of the things we talk about a lot is the fact that if he doesn't have great immunity, he can't do anything. He can't perform to where he wants to be. So he needs his great immunity. He's only going to get that if he like sleeps well, as we've talked about, you know, because that can really affect your immunity piece. And it is this full circle picture, isn't it, of good sleep, good recovery, good immunity, and making sure that you are always bearing all of those things in mind in order to perform better, whether it be a 24-hour dance-a-thon, whether it be climbing Snowdonia, whether it be just doing a presentation at work.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think the way to exactly what's always been interesting to me is that, you know, I started off in elite sport and then was the director of research for the British Olympic Medical Centre and, you know, various other roles through that, is that to some extent what I've done, if you sort of drill down into it, is I'm translating what we do with elite athletes into other populations. And most of it needs adapting, but fundamentally it holds true. And I think one of the critical things is that when you're working with an elite athlete, what you know is that the performance itself is actually made up of a number of different pillars. And the crucial factor around training is to try and enhance each of those pillars. You know, for your husband, for example, it's not just about strength. There is a strength endurance component to it. There's also an aerobic component to it. Add on top of that is an incredible technical component to it. So, you know, what you're actually in, how you're operating it. And then there's a tactical component to it. And so to some extent, what we're trying to do when we dissect down to something like sleep is what you're looking for is you're looking for what we call the determinants, the determinant parts. What determines high quality sleep is going to be made up of lots of different things. And what we need to do is actually try and optimize each of those different factors. And in doing so, this wonderful term that we use in high performance is marginal gains. But actually, it runs true across life. And that is that if you can get a 1% gain in each of those pillars, then if there are 10 determinants, all of a sudden you've got a 10% gain in sleep quality. And so it's just making sure that you sort of dissect it down, understand it. And then critically, what people do is that they're very good at working on things that they're good at and they're successful at. And the things that they're not really good at and they don't particularly like, they push to the side. Where for me, I think the one thing that you should always think about is that the greatest gains in performance, whatever that performance is, the greatest gains generally always come from those things that you don't like doing.
So interesting that you say that.
Never shy away from things.
Yeah, and it's so interesting you say that because we had Michael Johnson, the sprinter, on the pod a few months back. And the thing he said was so extraordinary about his coach, Coach Hart, who came on with him as well, actually, was that he just sort of sowed the seed in his head one day about the things he could be doing a bit more of. And he said they were always the things he hated and never wanted to do and didn't put so much importance on. But he said the minute he started to pay attention and very cleverly coach had sort of sewn it in a throwaway line, he realized the difference it could make to the whole picture. And I think that is so true, like you've said, of people in everyday life. Like the one amazing thing about sport is, and I agree with you, you can take so many lessons from how an elite athlete approaches competition to how anyone who's sort of a busy professional can approach their daily life. This term human performance, I don't think it's in most people's vernacular, but actually that's a sort of fascinating phrase, isn't it? Because it is about a human and it is about performance. And when you put the two together, the differences that you can make, like you say, could be just incremental here and there, but fundamentally can contribute so hugely to the bigger picture. Do you find that is that a message that's easily received from everyday people as opposed to the athletes that you work with who already will understand that because they're living and breathing it? They're already in that program.
I think, yes, it is. It is definitely about the translation, about how you deliver that message. But I think, let's just take a look in sort of the general population. The classic, you know, we're coming close to Christmas. The classic is New Year's resolutions. You know, if you ever want to see how badly a goal should be assessed or delivered, then New Year's resolutions are it. You know, because what we've just spoken about is incremental change. And effectively, we would translate that in the sporting context into what we call progressive overload. Is that, you know, what you do is you progressively increase the challenge on the body so that it is able to adapt to it. And of course, come New Year's resolutions, what we do is we wake up on New Year's Day, having been out, you know, on the pop the night before, and we say, right, by the end of January, I'm going to lose 3 stone. And you're thinking to yourself, well, unless you remove a limb, that is never going to happen, you know. And so lo and behold, you know, those New Year's resolutions generally, on average, only last about 21 days. Because what people don't see is they don't see the gains because they don't progress in at a rate that they have expected to progress. So I think what's really important is, yes, it definitely is what you should adopt across. I mean, the idea of goal setting, so we've got this sort of massive primary goal, but dissecting that down into medium term and then into short term goals is absolutely crucial to deliver success. But it is making sure that you have the right goal with the right timing that are achievable but challenging, all of these type of things, various different models that you can use. But it is definitely something that everybody can use. It's just making sure that you do it in the right way.
What's the first thing you say to people when they want to undertake these crazy, crazy challenges with you? Is there one thing that you sort of come out with when you take that first meeting with them and you say, this is how we're going to do this? Is there one little nugget that they hear first before everything else?
I think there is. And I think what I call it is the central motivator is the why. And I think the why really matters, because having that central motivator really does matter, because you have to keep coming back to it. You don't talk about it all the time. It's not omnipresent. But what you do is you just come back to it, because what you can do is you can forget, you know, into a big challenge in preparation for it. Let's say we've got 3 months to prepare. After a month, you're thinking, oh, why am I doing this? And then just to remind yourself about why you set out on the journey in the first place is really, really important. And I think making sure that why is a very personal thing.
is really important as well. What you can never do is take on these type of challenges because you're doing it for somebody else, because it never works, because it has to be personal. So, you know, if I give you an example of that, I remember when we swam the channel, I mean, it's a long time ago, I still remember it. So it tells you how important it was. But I remember David Walliams had visited a project in Ethiopia. And it was a refuge for young girls who had been systematically raped by the militia. And this shelter was a hospitality education center. So they were teaching these young girls to actually move into the hospitality sector. And I just remember David had met this one particular child, and it had really sort of gripped him about how important this money was that he was raising and what difference it could make to her life. And that individual became the central motivator. You know, however miserable he felt, however tired he was, however cold he was, however far he still had to go, just to be reminded about what a difference he could make by keeping going was enough just to refocus the effort and keep moving on. And you know, it doesn't have to be that type of thing, but I think that central motivator. So the first thing I always talk about is why. Why are you doing this? And once you get into that, I think what you can then do is you can then build around it. And so it really does matter. The why matters.
And that can become a very emotional thing. I mean, what you just described is a very emotive issue. And you know, so how do you, can you use that and focus it and channel it? Or can that become a problem in itself because you have to manage it, because there, you know, all these emotions and this, you know, this thing where people really want to do the best possible thing because there's so many other more important things going on that depend on it happening. So, you know, how do you sort of manage that with somebody? Because it's not just because you want to do it, it's for a much bigger purpose.
Yeah. And it's an interesting one, that, because these are incredibly emotional environments. I mean, anything where you're pushing yourself to the limit, and we've spoken about things like sleep deprivation, anybody knows, going back to the small children thing, you will start crying at the drop of a hat when you've had, you know, 5 nights of really poor sleep. Everything becomes emotional. Life becomes emotional. But I think the crucial thing is just making sure that you coin it in such a way as to remember inside that why, It's not necessarily the person per se. It's about what you're doing in order to affect that outcome. And so it's about just making sure that you remember why you're doing it, yes, but actually remember that the reason why we're doing this is to actually deliver an outcome. Now, you know, for an elite athlete, that tends to be an Olympic gold medal. And you might think that's not as important, but of course it's incredible. It's the most important thing to an elite athlete. It's all that matters to an elite athlete. So, but to my mind, that's the byproduct of the reason why you're doing it in the first place. So, I mean, the one thing I always say to particularly to parents of junior athletes who say, you know, we'd love our child to go to the Olympic Games. We'd love him to win a medal at the Olympic Games. And I say to them, look, the most important thing is that it is their dream and not your dream. Because invariably what will happen is that if it's their dream and they're pushing, As soon as that athlete gets an opportunity to make their own decision, they're out of the sport because it's not what they do, it's not what they love. So making sure that you love what you do, I think, is really important. And part of that love is knowing what the outcome is and how you are affecting the outcome.
But my God, it must be a struggle sometimes when people are on that day, whatever it is that you mentioned, or hour 18 of 24, and they're absolutely on the floor, crushed, broken, need rebuilding, need motivating. How the heck do you keep them on track in those final moments of whatever it might be? Is there a particular thing that you say to them? I mean, I know you can remind them of the why, but even at that moment, I guess they're thinking, I don't care, I'm absolutely broken. I mean, how do you keep them going?
Well, the interesting thing there is actually then it becomes about the challenge. It doesn't necessarily become about, I mean, they're already in it. I think the why really works in terms of the preparation for it, the amount of work that you've got to put in. You know, the one thing I always say is, look, success is not a chance event. You haven't decided to enter the London Marathon and then sit on the sofa watching telly. You know, you can't just watch Forrest Gump and expect to be able to run a marathon. You know, so that why piece is often for the real misery. And actually, the challenge itself is less miserable because you're part of the challenge. But there is where goal setting really matters. So one of the things that we do, so for example, you know, with Vernon last week, when we talk about the ultra marathon, is that what you never do is think about the whole thing. You know, it's the trite saying, if you don't eat an elephant in one bite. But in doing that, what you do is you contract it down into manageable chunks. So these short-term goals become really important. So what we're doing now is that, number one, is we have pit stops, for example, on Vernon's challenge. And those pit stops are set at 7 miles apart, so it's just over 10K. So now, instead of thinking, right, I've got a 40-mile day, what you're thinking is, all I've got to do is make it to 10 kilometers. So I've got to make it 10 kilometers. And then actually what I'll do is actually, rather than talk about that, what we'll do is we'll actually dissect that even further into miles. So let's not worry about what we're going to do, you know, how long it's going to take us to get to 10K. Let's think about how long is it going to take us to get to 1 mile? And then the question becomes, so a great example, in the water, we did this. So when we swam across the channel with David, for example, is that you feed every 30 minutes and you basically get about 30 seconds every 30 minutes to hydrate and to feed. And so the questions that I was always asking David, it wasn't, you know, we're 10 miles done, but the way that it works, you know, you've got another sort of 15 miles. Can you make 15 miles? I mean, it's just like you've blown it out of the water. The question was always, can you swim for another 30 minutes? So can you swim? Yeah. Can you make it to the next feed? And of course, the answer to that question is always yes. So now, instead of actually thinking about the big picture, what you're thinking about is actually, it's just all it is about the next 30 minutes. And you get to the next 30 minutes, you have something to eat. What next 30 minutes? And so dissecting it down is really the way to do it. So on the 24-hour challenges, is that the way I construct it on the 24-hour challenge is that every hour we have a 5-minute rest break to go to the toilet, to have something to eat. But also what I'll do is change shoes and socks for the guys, make sure that we're looking after the feet because the feet really matter. But every time they get back on, what they're thinking about is the next 55 minutes. They're not thinking about, I've got 18 hours to go. And that I think really matters in life in general. Think about the now. You know, be present is something we talk about a lot. But actually think about the now. Don't worry about how far away you are.
You're like the world's most perfect person to speak to about what people need to do to achieve better daily performance. Because I feel like this 24-hour thing is just ingrained in your thinking. So if someone wants to have a better day than the day before, what is the one thing that they could do to channel if they want to achieve that?
Well, for me, I think it very much is around, I mean, I would call it preparation and planning. But to some extent, to simplify that, it's about structure. And I think it's about being very clear about what you are trying to achieve today. Now, it doesn't have to be over detailed. But the thing is that at the beginning of the day, you're having your coffee and you think to yourself, I've got to do this, that, and the other. By 11 o'clock in the morning, you've forgotten what that list was. And you're not sure if you've ticked any off. And then you get to about 6 o'clock in the evening, you think, oh my God, I forgot to do X, Y, Z. And now it's a panic. Now the stress rises because now you've got to get it done and you haven't got enough time and the kids are home from school. So it's actually about structure. And I think what's really important around that is actually writing it down. I mean, you'll often see me on the phone notes. You know, I use notes an awful lot, but even if you look at my desk, there's scribbles on it. And what those scribbles are is effectively just to structure the day so that what I can do is I'm aiming to achieve a particular goal. Once that is done, a tick goes on it. Now, what's great about that is now what I've got is I've actually now got a list halfway through the day where there might be 5 or 6 ticks on it. Now, that is incredibly motivating because the feedback from that is telling me that I'm actually getting things achieved. Things are actually happening. We're starting to get things done. And so it becomes self-fulfilling. Is that actually what you are doing, you're starting to tick it off. Add on top of that, if there are people around you, I mean, I would always, you know, work, for example, put it in the diary so people know what you're doing and when you're trying to achieve it. And so therefore, and when they tick it, they can see that you're making progress as well. You don't have to explain it to people. So for me, I think the most important thing is actually around structure. It sounds a bit, you know, it sounds a bit like, oh, I've got to write everything down. But it's much, once you get good at it, it's much looser than that. But if you look at successful people, effectively what they're able to do is set goals and tick them off. And that's really what it's all about. Keep moving forward.
What's left on your to-do list today?
Well, do you know what? I've had a very good day thus far because it started early. I was actually out with I was squad training this morning. I still swim with the squad here at Wickham District Swimming Club. So I was up at 5 for a swim squad. So that's my exercise done for the day, which is fabulous, actually. It's really lovely. You know, and we know what it's like, don't you? Exactly, tick. I haven't got to think about, when am I going to squeeze a session in? There's always plenty on my lists.
I love it.
But that's okay.
you're almost the only person that could convince me that a 24-hour challenge would be a good idea, but only if you were leading it. Thanks, Greg.
We'll have some fun. Let's do it. Come on, let's do it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.